call the work session for April 25th to order. Note that Councillor Harrington is off in Japan studying what happens if you have a big earthquake, and therefore is excused. First item of business is COO Communications.
I have two items of my own. I have two guest stars today, so I apologize that I'm breaking the rule of three. First, I want to make sure I got your okay to send the Levy Ready Columbia letter, which was, I think, emailed to you by Robert Gonzalez earlier today. If you haven't had a chance to see it, I'll pass it around. Councillor Craddock asked for it. You guys are all putting the thumbs up. It's been reviewed by Governor Ferris, Policy Department, and Councillor Wade. So, if we have a said that, okay, that was easy. Second, I want to make sure you were all invited to the Metro All Staff meeting over at OCC, which is Thursday morning from 10 to noon. I know that's a council meeting. It is public service week next week, so we'll be talking about public service. We'll also be presenting the first ever Global Tollbert Diversity Award at that. We're going to hear some stories from various metro departments, and so talking about sort of great examples in metro's history of public service. And so if you have time, 10 to noon, over at OCC in rooms 256 and 257. All right. Who wants to hear the first guest star? I think we'll have to have the first guest star. You might have more questions than Don.
Hey, councilors. Good afternoon. I just want to take a couple minutes of your time. I'm here in Paul Simon's place today to ask whether or not you'd like to give staff permission to develop a program through which Metro would provide grants or grants and loans to solid waste industries to help diversify recycling and reuse markets while also advancing the goals of Metro's equity strategy. This type of work is not unfamiliar to Metro. About 20 years ago, we had a grant program. We also have a policy within the Regional Solid Waste Management Plan that says that Metro can foster the development of reuse and recycling markets. Martha, Paul, and I talked about this, and the reason we're coming to you now to gauge your interest in directing us to undertake this program is really threefold. First, the interest that many of you have expressed in fostering entrepreneurship and innovation in the solid waste industry. Second, our desire and our need to implement programs and projects in the solid waste area to advance the equity strategy. And then third, the basic fact that Metro has received a number of one-off requests from members of the solid waste industry for funding, and you're all nodding your heads, you're familiar with those. And the reality is that in the absence of some kind of framework for doing this that's transparent, has accessibility to all that might be interested in this, this would be a really problematic thing for us to do on a one-off basis. So if you direct us to undertake the development of such a program, we come back to you with a number of things. First, clear statements of the goals and objectives that we're trying to achieve and a connection to the Regional Solid Waste Management Plan and to the equity strategy. Second, a draft criteria for grants and loans, and we would be informed by best practices in-house at the TOD program, as well as best practices around the country. We'd also take a look at the lessons learned from when we tried to undertake similar work 20 years ago. We'd come back to you with a recommended budget for what would potentially go outside the building, and also an implementation plan that includes the resources necessary to actually administer such a program. And then we also accompany that with some draft code language. There's some existing code that we can start with, so there would be amendments to come up to term. So we're basically here to say whether to ask whether you'd like to direct us to undertake that work, knowing that the product will come back to you subsequently.
Great.
So I understand you'll come back with a budget if we do this, but what's the scope in general that you're thinking of, and then where would that money come from?
So I think the initial conversations we've had would be scope in 2 to 3 million range, and then
this would be an annual thing.
This would be an annual thing, and would be drawn from the solid waste reserve fund.
There's sufficient funds inside the solid waste fund, I think, to pay for the program. It's really a question now of just how much interest there'll be. The TOD program is so thinking about meals, and we can come up with this comfortable. They budget $8 million a year. They end up spending for between $2 and $3 million a year. And I imagine this would be similar. We budget probably a higher amount than we would actually receive in grant requests and have them out the door. That's very polite, too. I know that if you had a request from a very particular business owner who's looking for some financing before July 1st, and I just want you to know this is not going to meet that person's needs. But I do think that this person's request causes us to think about the fact that we do have code that suggests we should have a program, but because the program that we created 20 years ago didn't work, we don't have one right now, so we do need to have that discussion. But it's not in either the timing or the specific request that you've been presented for.
Sam?
That might not do everything we want all at once, but I really like the track that you're on and appreciate and give a thumbs up. I thought you said you were going to look at other models around the country and maybe best practices and maybe some examples of the types of things that would, you know, make it through the hopper in terms of meeting program goals, objectives, criteria, and I just support that. I think that's really a helpful way to, you know, envision where we want to go. Amen.
Yeah.
We would need to be aware of what's going on around the country because we wouldn't want to provide a grant to something that's already been studied and there's answers. So we need to know.
And actually, the field trip we took earlier on to the Toronto region almost implies to me that we should expand that to beyond to North America, because I know the Canadians are doing a lot of stuff too. It's pretty innovative.
Okay, so I'm not hearing any disagreement.
Yeah. No, thumbs up.
Thumbs up. Good job. Thank you. Good job. Brian,
yes, sir. I'm ready to share your listening with me. I have all met Deputy Director Sherry Gorski, and also the people. So we're here today to talk about Shine. Shine was born to Patty and Pat years ago, and she's now tested positive for TB. We've reconvened the working group. We established with Patty and agreed on four priorities. I'm going to hand off to everybody after this. To protect human health and safety, that's staff and public. To prevent TB transmission to other animals, to provide the best possible care and welfare for Shine, and to maintain community trust and provide accurate information in a timely manner. And so what we've done so far is, as soon as we got the test results, we notified the health authorities again. So that's Dr. Vines, the Deputy Multnomah County Health Officer, and Dr. Vives, the Oregon Health Authority Veterinarian, who have been working very, very closely with us over the last several years. They visited the zoo on Friday. Dr. Vines is convening a working group to continue to assess the situation and to then provide direction to the zoo. In the meanwhile, they've told us it's safe to keep Forest Hall and elephants lands open to the public with elephants on exhibit. They recommend new protocols, which have already been put into practice. We're increasing the frequency of testing, so Shine is now being tested 3 times per week, and the rest of the herd is being tested monthly. They've recommended stricter personal protection practices, so type of suit usage and safety zones that we kind of didn't have before. All waste is now going to a landfill, where before some waste was being composted via the ZU program, now all waste is going to the landfill. We've separated Shine from the other elephants, and we want to begin treatment as soon as possible. So we need to assume that her TB strain is the drug-resistant strain, and we're not treating them with rifampin or the fluoroquinolones. There are 4 other drugs involved, including the isoniazid that Patty was not kind of comfortable with physically. One of these is a new drug that takes 140 pills per day. So we've ordered these drugs, and in the meanwhile, we're using vitamin C
as a training
pill. So she's being trained to accept these pills. So the medications have been ordered, and she's in her training program. She's kept in a different area from where Patty was kept, and we're working on remediation of that space still. So the big question is how Cheyenne became infected, and the answer is we just don't know yet. There's a remote chance she was exposed long ago, and that she had latent TB, and as I think you know from previous conversations about this, humans can be tested for latent TB, but elephants can't. So she's only now testing positive. But more likely is that this is a new case, which could mean she was infected by Rama, Tusco, or Patty before the strain became drug resistant, or she was infected by some kind of Patty contact after the strain became drug resistant. Or she's infected with a completely different strain from some unknown source, from history or something. So financial implications are as yet unknown. We have unanticipated costs for remediation, for treatment, and et cetera, and those are going to be taken into account moving forward. The Zoo Communications team is here. We want to give you complete and accurate information as it becomes available so that you can answer constituent questions. And I have a summary of this that I'll hand out, and then Sherry has a big huge and we've attached to it. So with that, are there any questions?
I think you mentioned in your preliminary report to us that the testing is underway of the bacteria that we have from Shine to indicate whether or not it's the same strain that Packy had. We'll find that out in a couple of weeks, or do we?
The most likely first date would be next Friday, so the 5th of May.
Thanks.
And it all just depends on getting enough growth on a culture to be able to test it. So it's either that Friday or the Friday following.
And just to be clear, because we went through this with Tusco and Packy and all of the others actually at some point along the way, she's actually infected. It's not that she's showing signs that she was exposed to, but she actually is infected with the disease.
Right, she's showing no signs.
No signs of the disease.
Right, but a test, so it's barely showing, which is a good thing. But out of 6 possible tests, 1 culture group. So there's active TB that really from the sample that came from her.
Right, and it came from a trunk wash,
yes. Yeah. And they, out of those, they take that and they plate 3 solid samples and 3 liquid samples. After 8 weeks, all the solid samples were clear, and 2 of the 3 liquid samples were clear, and 1 or 2 showed positive. And then that goes into a different test that then showed positive, but it's not very conclusive. It tests for MTB complex, so it could be Ambovis, and there were some cattle samples in there. So our first hope was that it was contaminated by a cattle sample, and that was proven not to be the case. And then they did PCR to check specific for the appropriate TB, and that was positive. And then they did an active test for active fast bacteria tests, which were present. So we've now tested 3 possible ways, making it we don't have a backdoor anymore.
One of the things that I've discovered in all of these cases that is similar is that there is nothing involved in the collecting of samples or testing of samples that I want to discuss around lunch. So it all sounds groovy to me, and I'm just glad that somebody else is doing it.
Sherry, there is an update to the first FAQs.
Yes, sure. So the very first FAQ says that results suggest that she's positive for TB, and this was done right when this happened, this time last week. And then in the second question, when we know for sure, it says 2 to 3 weeks. In truth, we know for sure now. What we'll know in 2 to 3 weeks is what strain it is.
Right.
We get the genomics in that time.
Which then will give us a clue as to what procedure will, what course of treatment will take.
Exactly. It'll let us know if we have additional drugs we can use.
Yeah.
It'll let us know if our protocols from that we were using during the packing time failed or not.
Okay. Sure.
Thank you. Isolating a female is different than isolating a male. So how is she doing, and then how is her doing? That she was a matriarch, correct? Isn't she the matriarch?
Yeah, she was the auntie.
Yes, I think that's fair. She's doing well, and we've changed protocol so that we have two keepers that are dedicated to her each day, and that's positive in two ways. One, she gets a lot more attention, and they've devised exercise programs for her and a lot of enrichment and a lot of attention. And the other thing that's positive is that those people are then not going and working with the other elephants, so it's a little tighter protocol in terms of isolation as well. So. But she's doing well so far. It is more challenging. The rest of the herd is also doing well. Rose, too, is cycling right now, which means Scooter can't be with her, so it's like chess. But.
Go ahead.
So we heard for a while that Samudra was with her. Is that not the case?
That's not my actual question. But he is when she's not cycling. But when she
is shine.
Oh, with shine. It's true. The first day we got the results, he was with her anyway.
Okay.
And so we left it that way while we were trying to get from 80 to 98% sure.
Yeah.
And these samples that were run were taken February 23rd, 24th, and 25th, and she was with all the elephants in those 8 weeks. So once we were really sure, we did isolate, but on that day, you know, the difference from 8 weeks plus one day didn't seem.
But so do we have, I mean, one of the things we've learned is that it lives longer in the soil and water, all of those things. What kinds of precautions are we taking now? Can we do something to the soil, to the sand, to the water?
Yeah, it's a great question. We're all asking that question as well. So we just pulled up some older studies of other facilities that have dealt with TB, and they tested a lot of surfaces and found no evidence of TB on any of their surfaces. We're talking about testing the soil. But again, the reason that all of the elephant waste is now going to landfill rather than to Zulu is that we're just assuming everybody's infected.
Mm-hmm.
Exposed, not infected,
I think this is
the more appropriate terminology. So assuming everyone's exposed, and so we have to weigh the cost benefit. They've all been with that soil and whatever. So that's true of that exhibits in Forest Hall. The space where Packy was, and we know he was actively shedding to a great degree, we're going to remediate and await for proposals on that. We should have by end of today. And that is removing all the soil and washing down the walls using Velcro and a much more serious clean out before we put her in that space, because we don't know what's wrong.
I hate to play the geeky scientist, but I will. So we've decided to use an adaptive management approach because this is an opportunity to learn, as painful as this opportunity is and this situation is. But we are going to be taking tests of the sands before we remove it, and then after we remove 18 inches, we're going to test it again, and then hold those tests off and see if the TB is in place, so see what we can learn for other facilities.
I guess the other geeky thing to add would be that TB is very susceptible to any sort of bleach, any disinfectant, and it's also very susceptible to UV light, which kills it pretty quickly. So all the outdoor spaces are much safer, and so the sand and Forest Hall would be the biggest concern, but again, they all are even exposed to that. And so, and the amount of shedding, we believe, is very small. So that's the bacteria. The bacteria coming out. Yeah. So just the way we transmit any virus or bacteria is like when you cough or sneeze, then there's tiny particles that come out. So that's what we refer to shedding. Thank you for asking.
And then we do that when it's active, not when it's latent, right? So when it's latent, it's just in the body, not active, and it's not coming out through the trunk, and so you don't see it.
So
when they're actively shedding, we see it in the trunk line.
And the whole rest of the herd is negative on that same set of samples. So from the end of February, we're all confirmed negative. So as far as we know.
Okay.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, guys.
I want to see them.
Yes. Appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah, really appreciate it.
percentage.
Yes, thank you.
Yes. Okay, then. That would be it. So, next order of business is technical elements of the Metro Land Use Analytical Toolkit.
That's the.
And that's just the title.
Yeah, that's the title. Not the technical title.
So, some more DD science.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure that's in your guys' job description.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes.
Props are working here. Good afternoon, counselors and colleagues. Thanks for having me. The title is here to basically inform you about the ongoing work that we do to upgrade the analysis toolkit that does data analytics and forecasting for the planning process for several things: the regional transportation plan, the urban growth management cycle, the Metropolitan Transportation Improvement Plan. It's going to dwell a lot on land use and the aspects of that, so you folks are aware of what we're doing in our ongoing work to enhance those tools and make sure that they're currently allowable. The real objective here is to, what are we saying? The screen is the past screen. Alright. I just wanted to make sure it's working here. And I just wanted to take a moment, if I may, to thank the staff in my department who work on our land use analytics team and introduce them to you. You'll be seeing more of them. I'm not going to do all the talking here in the next couple of years. But Dennis Yee, Metro Economist. Mm-hmm. So, Dennis, would you just stand
up? No, you'd be recognized.
Dennis. Mary Beth Todd, who is another economist by training, who is very skilled at statistics and some of the heavy-duty science and math in this. Jim Serr, who is the one in charge of a lot of software engineering introducing the toolkit. And we'll have a little bit of a talk later about the vision and responsibility that my team is putting into play as we go through the next couple of years. The information I wanted to convey to you today really covers four broad topics. First of all, I wanted to start by affirming some basic values by which my team and I conduct our work, which, of course, connect to the Metro values. And I do this sort of to let you folks know where we're coming from as analysts, but also to give you, hopefully, a common ground as you talk to your constituents and stakeholders to have a sort of common starting place on how Metro does a lot of this work. I know that this topic, the topic of these forecast results, sometimes becomes contentious. I want to specifically then brief you on some of the changes we're making to the toolkit. I know that many of you are interested in the details of how we do the analytics as they inform your decisions in these planning processes. So I just want to be sure that you hear all the information about what we're doing in case you folks get questions. I also want to bring to your attention some outreach that we have added to the types of outreach that the planning department and you folks do around technical topics in their planning processes. And so I just want to make you folks aware of that, because again, that means that we'll be talking to folks outside the building who are most often staff to other agencies or your constituents, and so you may hear about some of these things. I just want you folks to know what's going on. And then we wanted to conclude with a mock-up or preview of the types of information that you might hear about as we go through the specific planning process that's leading towards including the urban growth management cycle in 2018 with a decision by you folks. And Ted, who's here, you may call upon him if you have certain questions this week. You may recall in February on how the planning department has worked with you to scope out that overall work process. And so this is really talking about the types of information that you might see, because as you recall, Ted and our other colleagues in planning are staging that a little bit differently than past cycles. So, moving on then, talking about analytic principles, I just wanted to, as I said, affirm some of the values that we come from, and really in our work that produces data analysis, produces forecast findings, I like to think of this as being derived from the metro values of public service and mass office. But I also want to talk about how all of our teammates of this effort fit in to our point of view as analysts. And of course, our primary role as representatives is to provide you folks decision support information. So you're the decision makers. You get to make the value judgments and get to make the decision. Our planning colleagues, in our view, sort of are the shepherds of the process. So they are process engineers who make sure that things are happening, that we are engaging all the stakeholders, that there's time enough to do this, that we are addressing all the planning factors, things like that. And the analysts then, in my group, really are trying to provide good science. So we support you by looking at what things are reproducible. So if you look at the way science is done in any field, climate science or veterinary science on how we cure elephants of infectious diseases, you know, if you're doing experiments, you want to be sure that if you give someone else the same data and the same tools, they'll come up with the same results. That means things are reproducible. You're not doing anything different. You're not doing anything weird. We also work hard to make sure that things are defensible. And in our context, for a lot of the forecast analytics we do, there is a broad array of experience around the country and around the world. There is a long history of academic research, of practice by folks like ourselves, of technical work by consultant teams. And so we work to be sure that our methods are consistent with the best practice in the field, as would be judged by an expert from a university or a consulting firm or another peer metropolitan planning organization. We also then go through exercises with our models, and I'll talk a little bit more about this later, where we validate them, which is a term of art that we use in our field that says, okay, let's run the model from some historic point to some other historic point and see if it produces results that are reasonably similar to what actually happened. Then finally, of course, it's our job to not impose our personal values as analysts on what we bring to you. And so my staff and I are committed to bringing you information that is unbiased, which means we don't decide the value of it. We simply follow the other practices and bring you the information. We explain the technical implications of it, the factual implications of it, but there's a line where we don't cross, which we say, okay, anything beyond that is a value judgment. That's up to you folks. So I just wanted to do that. And we also, of course, the footnote has been cut off. I've cited you folks. I've cited other elected officials in the regions, sort of teammates from our view, our analysts, planners. But I also want to thank the attorneys in the OMA, because I have not yet had the privilege of having attorneys in-house, so it's really invaluable to us to be able to talk about state law requirements or the DLCB guidance or federal planning requirements and have qualified attorneys to make sure that we're actually complying with law and regulations. So there are teammates also in this exercise. So moving on now, I promised to talk about some of the things that we are doing to enhance our land use analytics. And to do that, I have to start with a little bit of grounding in what the toolkit is, just so we have common terms of reference. I want to start with the diagram you've seen before that really scopes out the entire urban growth management process. And in my view, from the Research Center, kind of shows us the intersection points between the planning process and some of the analytical things that we do to support it. You've seen this before. As you may recall, the last time I was actually presenting to you on a land use topic, you folks were approving the distributed forecast. So, there it is. So, the last time we talked about a land use topic, you folks approved the distributed forecast, which is the details of where jobs and people are going to be within the region that we use for things like the regional transportation plan analysis and to coordinate with our local workers. We're, as Ted said, we're really launching into a new phase of urban growth management that's going to culminate in a decision. The EGB amendment that we needed in calendar 2018 So right now, my department is here at Step 6. We're talking about the fact that we are enhancing our models, we're getting additional data, and we're really preparing to be sure that all the tools are ready to go for the next cycle. So that said, here's just an inventory. So I sort of conceived this slide as a cheat sheet for you folks if you need to think about what are the main tools that those RC folks use. We produce the range forecast, which is the long-range forecast of total jobs and total population in the region out into a future point in time using something we call the regional economic model. So that's one key tool. The second key tool is ultimately sort of a data product, a buildable lands inventory. And as I'm sure you folks know, you've lived through it more than I've, frankly, since I've run to it here. The buildable lands inventory is a product that is created through a process where planning staff and research center staff engage local agencies around the region to really inventory what land do we have, what's its capacity. We'll spend more time talking about those details. And we'll produce really a product that says what's the potential supply? What's kind of the really maximum we can get out of the existing inventory of land? The third major tool we use is Metroscope. We're all familiar with that word. And in brief, what Metroscope does is it simulates the market. It says, okay, we have a certain amount of potential supply, we have a certain amount of people, we have a certain amount of economic activity, we have a certain amount of wealth in the region to go around, so what's the market going to do when we're actually selling new construction to firms or households? And so it produces certain details that we use to bring you folks information into the process. As I mentioned a moment ago, the thing we just most recently completed is that the fourth tool, which we'd really like to talk about today, is the tool that produces a distributed forecast, and internally we call that particular tool MapPack. So if you hear us use that word, forgive us, but that tool is what produces a distributed forecast. And this is where we take the results of the other forecast and take them down to the jurisdictional level. So how many households and jobs are going to be in Hillsborough versus the eastern part of Blackness County versus Wilsonville, et cetera, et cetera. And the process of talking, again, which we've been doing throughout all of these steps with the local agency partners, really helps complete our coordination with them, which again is a state. So is that making sense? Four major tools, each do different things. They run sort of in a linear fashion. And so here's the process chart of where the tools enter in, just for another quick reference. The first step, analytically speaking at least, is what planning homework that goes before this really is to produce the range forecast. The regional economic model kicks that out. We get population formula. And then in getting to prepare the information that you folks see in the Urban Growth Report, which in my view of the world is really the decision support information packaged into a tight package, we apply Metroscope and the Buildable Lands Inventory. Buildable Lands Inventory really is an input to Metroscope to our group of world. There's discussion, there's a lot of planning discussion, discussion with you folks about what does that information mean, are there efficiency measures to take, the meter of growth boundary expansion, and Ted has spoken to you about how that will be packaged in the next cycle. We'll come back to that in a minute. And then, so by calendar 2018, in calendar 2018, we'll be there. And I'm not willing to talk further about that at this point. So that's sort of how the toolkit fits into the process. So I'm going to start now talking about some of the enhancements. And there's really two major ones. One of them is that we are working now actually with a consulting team and a lot of staff effort from planning and also the investment groups we're about to enhance the way we do the global landscape. And again, having been through this before, I think as I described earlier, this is really a process in general of saying, okay, you know, what's the market value of various land that's available for greenfield development, redevelopment, infill development, And what are the suppliers, the developers, actually going to do with that capacity? What could they do, which is sort of the zoning, what's the maximum permitted or the minimum that we enable? And then, given the market conditions, what are they actually going to do? And so, the key question there, of course, is what are they going to do? How many units is that going to provide for housing, or how many square feet of commercial or industrial space will that provide in the future? So those are the big questions. The way that we have done in the past is relatively straightforward on the first two steps. So you say, okay, there are parklands, natural areas, and things that are off limits. Say, okay, for other reasons, there's other land, public infrastructure, parks, schools, easements, right of way, street right of way,
steep slopes, wetlands, those kinds of things as well.
Yeah. And so that's on the environmental constraints side. And then this is the part that where we actually, in terms of identifying those tax lots, you know, individual parts of land that could redevelop or refill spaces, we have relied a lot on what I call handcrafted operations. We talk to our colleagues in Portland or Hillsborough or West Lynn, and we say, okay, what's going to happen to what could happen here? And so that's actually the part that we're proposing to change. So what we've done is we have hired a consultant, Johnson Economics. It's actually the same consultant that the TOD group here uses when they're looking at land deals and what to do around station areas or corridors. And we are really making more general for the application to the entire region a specific tool that that firm uses to support those local decisions. That means we're taking a pro forma approach, which is basically some economic math that developers do when they're trying to decide, hey, am I going to save millions of dollars into this property and put that investment in there and try to realize a profit? That then will, by incorporating those market calculations, give us a quantified estimate of what the actual market capacity is and at what intensity the market is likely to develop those tax laws. And the reason for that is listed here. As you folks well know, housing production, particularly in the region, is going to increasingly depend on multifamily units as well as redevelopment. And so the economic decisions that developers make to provide supply come down to some very fine calculations. And the fact that this gives us a quantitative estimate makes it easier to apply, more consistent across the region, more scientific, if you will. It also enhances the way that our toolkit as a whole simulates market behaviors. So I know chief folks have heard this, my staff have heard this, planning staff have heard this. How do we treat the market? Well, this is part of our answer. We're going to better simulate actual market behaviors. And as I mentioned before, this is really how our development staff think when they're looking at getting stuff done on the ground. And it's really how the actual developers think. So if I was wealthy and had a lot of money to sink in real estate, I would go out and I would probably hire someone like Johnson Economics to tell me if this particular investment's a good idea, they would basically do this type of thing.
So John, before you leave this, are you going to do this on a property by property basis, or is this going to be a pro forma applied study? Larger geographic areas? How does it actually kind of work?
It's going to work on the tax lines.
But so tax lot on the tax lot?
Yeah.
Okay.
Where there are characteristics that that our documentation will show.
It's a little modeling, essentially.
It's going to be a model.
Property by property, not the same for every vacant lot across the region that's going to be
right. Yeah. And it's also, there are differences. As you would expect, there are essentially about 38 different types of developments that the model is aware of. Multifamily, you know, this type of thing, with certain amounts of, there's different amounts of parking, because parking policies are changing, so there's a lot of different variety, and then those are based on things that firms are actually doing in response to what public policy has been done.
Bob, I think I had a question here too.
Thank you. Jeff, can you relate this to Metroscope? Is this a refinement of what we've tried to accomplish in the past with Metroscope, that is an approximation in a model of the marketplace? Are we adding more detail to the algorithms or whatever drive
sure.
Metroscope?
Let me answer that in a couple of steps.
Sure, thanks.
The tools are listed in this order because this is actually the order in which we apply.
Yeah.
So in revising the BLI, we're applying basically a model in this phase now that better says, okay, let's suppose it's zoned for 20 stories. For example, down the street where it was zoned, I don't know exactly the details, but it was zoned for a number of stories and they actually built something that was less.
Yeah.
So that's the calculation we're now introducing upstream of Metroscope. So
okay.
Metroscope does a better understanding of, rather than just its own capacity, Metroscope says, oh, okay, the market's probably going to be this capacity.
My child's garden versus understanding of Metroscope was that it was going to do that step of assessing whether the market is likely to go that high.
And that's a great question. What I just narrated of putting it in this step is our interim solution against 2018.
Uh-huh.
Our long-term solution is to incorporate everything I just described in Metroscope.
Gotcha.
So this is going to take away from a planner-by-planner eyeballing an aerial map saying, I think this is 4 stories sometime in the next 20 years, and now we'll model it. Okay. Right now, the way we do it is we send it out in the planner's eyeball and say,
right.
I think this is 4 stories.
So now what we're going to send out is the model version to describe it. So we're going to send out this product and say, if you run the model on it, now you guys don't have to do as much in the parameters as I described earlier, but please review it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I
have a question on this. I think it's the slide, the next slide. I'm confused about why steps 4 and 5 aren't reversed. It seems to me that if the UGB amendment issue, why would that come up before the distribution of cities analysis is done?
Well, there's a legal answer to that. The need question is a regional question, not a local question. So
the question is, do we need to look further, basically? And if we assume that we need to look further, then we look at...
The other answer to that is practical.
Seems to me that when I'm in the middle of it, it feels like the UGB question is the last question. And this one is saying, no, that...
You're letting them sit down?
In fact, I sort of feel like a distributed forecast and stuff with the range forecast. So maybe the other question is the difference between those two. Maybe I'm asking a question.
No, I knew this.
So I saw the order.
There's a circular nature, as the diagram implies, to what we do. And at some point, we need to make assumptions from one decision into the next decision. And so in this case that you're pointing to, one of the assumptions that gets made in that distributed forecast is where the expansions are. So it becomes an input to that next process. We go through this sort of confusion bit too with forecasting for growth management versus forecasting for the RTP, and there's always an urge to try to sync those up more, but we have this chicken or the egg thing. We're always chasing our own tail on our assumptions and our outputs. So
the UGB is not, step 4 is not the UGB amendment decision, or is it?
It is, I think.
Then why would we do step 5 after that, I guess? If we're talking about how much...
Well, you're saying essentially, is there a need to expand the urban growth boundary at all? Answer to step 4. And if so, where? Answer to step 5.
Is that right?
Step 5 is the process that you all, you adopted it this last fall after the growth management decision, we worked with cities and counties to figure out, given that decision the council made on growth management, where is growth likely to go, both in existing urban areas and in those expansions, and some assumptions about future UGB expansions into urban reserves. It's not a perfect answer because, again, this is circular, and we do need to make assumptions at each step of the way, and those assumptions get informed by previous decisions.
So you are saying that we make, if and when we make a UGB expansion decision, we make that before we do the regional forecast distribution cities and counties?
Correct.
The way I think of it, let me add to what Ted said. The way I think about it is that the heavy-duty analytics of the market simulation I talked about, Metroscope runs, how much growth we're going to have, how much the developers are going to supply in response to the demands, all that is done before you make the UGB decision. That gets packaged into the Open Growth Report Theory. Last time there was a draft version, there was a final version, so there was new information brought in later. Probably in response to it, as I understood. I mean, I was coming into the agency to actually move it out, but that's where it happened, in response to questions you had. So all the critical information about making the regional need discussion or and decision is, has been done. From our point of view as analysts, step five here is taking that and not doing any new forecasting or changing the numbers, but just putting it down into very tiny little zones. So transportation planning can then kick off and do its work. So the entry analysis can work, knowing not just sort of generally where people are and jobs are going to be, but very specifically in like small, a couple blocks in downtown
Portland. Okay.
So it's not this step does not at all change the decision. It doesn't say we're going to have different amounts of housing, different amounts of commercial square footage. It just says, okay, we need to do other planning now with the results of the growth plan. And that planning is transportation. Transportation depends a lot on exactly, not just generally where people live and work, but exactly where people live and work.
Okay.
So it's really just
the data the same way.
Yes.
The same data for
can't hear you, Martha.
So you're not watching the transportation.
The counties use the data the same way we do. They use it for their water, sewer, storm drain, and transportation planning. So they need it because that's how they do their work.
But we don't need, it's not the base of our UGB expansion decision.
Right.
It is the outcome of our UGB expansion decision.
Yeah. It is more detail added to our UGB decision so that our processes can be more
solid. Okay, yeah, thank you. I appreciate that because I forgot to write. The loop was wrong.
I think I think our jurisdictional partners get confused about this too. So you remember that we often have a discussion with them during the distribution about who's getting which.
Right.
Yeah.
And or forcing them to take
or why are we not giving them this or right.
I think that's a fair observation. As I said, the last time I was before you on a land use topic, you were adopting the distributed forecast, and you may recall that it took two passes through impact to get because of the confusion. And so we have worked together to try to make things clearer to folks. And I sat with some of you talking about and looking at draft slides, and you helped give us some suggestions that would help. So we're trying to live that sort of new guidance and those new terminologies.
Yeah.
It's part of the confusion that we get into with our local jurisdictional partners. When they say things like you're assigning more growth to Portland than is fair, we don't actually assign growth to anything. We kind of predict where it is likely to go based on the factors that were with the market and the factors in terms of the growth.
And what the
city's telling us.
And we take the growth that we have forecast and we look at where growth is now, because that attracts commercial funds like Google on Rank, that attracts more firms, and we look at where construction has occurred recently, and we look at where the capacity is. Capacity, attracts some of the growth because it is an opportunity to develop.
Right. Great, great.
But I think maybe partially what causes the confusion is the way I think of how this system works, isn't there really another step between step three and step four? Because you take the urban growth report and then you apply the efficiency measures to it to determine what actually can happen for economic or other reasons. And what comes out of that is what I think you could call a technical conclusion. You reach a technical conclusion that we then use, to determine what the UGB amendment should be.
I think that's fair. The way I characterize what you just said, in my own mind, is that we actually kind of repeat this part of it. We produce.
Yeah, the efficiency measures part of it is a refinement of that.
We have some information now. Maybe that isn't headed the way that we or our stakeholders think it is productive. Let's try some efficiency measures or other adjustments. Let's test that again. And so there's sort of an iteration loop here that we sometimes do.
But doing that results in some information that we then use to evaluate whether or not a UGB amendment is needed or not. So there, in between there, there's an inclusion that's reached internally about whether or not there is, under current conditions, adequate space. And then we use that as, to make that decision, the UGB amendment decision. That's my thought. That's why I think that Carlotta was saying whether the regional forecast, that's what that would be. She would stick that between 3 and 4 because there's that forecast that tells us as a council whether or not we think we need to take an action to change the UGB.
Ted, you want to address that now? I walked the door literally just as you folks were making the ultimate step for decision last time. So,
Councilor Dixon, you're correct that there is more analysis that goes on after those types of efficiency measures are made. This diagram is a bit of a holdover from previous processes where that step of which efficiency measures are we going to take was a bit more explicit. The last growth management decision, we sort of incorporated all that into the initial analysis. In 2009, we did another growth report and then looked around the region for what can we do differently to use land more efficiently. So City of Hillsborough, for instance, adopted a new regional center for the Ask Metro 2. That's one example. City of Corvinus took their corridor and turned it into a town center. And we worked to figure out what those might mean in terms of future development. So this reflects that more explicit step in the previous process.
Well, I'm assuming that you forgot to put your code on.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So thank you for those useful questions. The other main thing I wanted to draw your attention to in the technical enhancement list is that I mentioned earlier that it's typical practice in our field as forecasters to validate our models. And so, you know, I've served other public agencies, I've worked as a consultant. It's a standard practice before you apply these models to a big decision to validate, which is essentially a term of art. It says, okay, how's the model doing relative to some observed condition? And so in our case, we're focusing a lot on the model's estimation of price. Housing unit prices by rental versus ownership and multifamily versus single family. We have quite some new data with which to do that. We have tapped into the RMLS folks. On the rental side, we have purchased some commercial databases that give us much more fine-grained information, both in time and in space, on what folks are experiencing in the rental market. And so we're using those observations to make sure that the model's price estimation is working, because that, of course, is fundamental to its market simulation of the prices that it's simulating in what I call model land, when computer software is actually running, are reasonable. And this is just an illustration that Johnson Economics helped us prepare of the owner price surface, as we call it, with the darker reds and oranges being more expensive land values, improved land values, and of course the more pre-converted dollars white being less expensive. So this is actually a product of some data analysis. And of course, there's a historical context to this to see how things have changed over time. We consult the census, which surveys people for the decennial years to what their land values are. And of course, we have building permit data. There's multiple sources of data. And I show this because we have simply plotted those discrete data points. And as you would expect, in the other market, there's a lot of oscillation with the business cycle and just historic economic. ophthalmic cycles. But there is a general trend, and of course our forecasting is going out well beyond the observed data, and so we just are examining what history can tell us about how these things in these markets are going to happen. So that's just an example of the types of data we can sell when we're looking at how models perform. And the results of that will be documented, that being the validation. And that is the same way to another topic, which is to just keep you informed about the technical outreach. The idea here being that we're now starting to talk about some things that are generic that we would do anytime we enhance our models, and we're also starting to talk about some outreach that's specific to the UGM process. So just the general stuff that we would do as a matter of course, we're doing now. As I said, we're enhancing the BLI. It's basically a little sub-model as we save and trade. And we're going to have local experts, academics, people in the real estate market, people who are coming down from Puget Sound Regional Council in Seattle to look, who do similar things to what we do at the Research Center. They're going to examine that. The pro forma approach in land use forecasting is something that other agencies are getting into, so we're very much in sort of in the wave of progress in this technical stuff. We are going to actually have a peer review of the Metroscope model itself once we've done validating it. So the validation report that I alluded to earlier is going to be something those experts will see and respond to. They'll give us their views on what we might do for further enhancements, on how well the model is doing in their judgment. Those are going to be folks who are a combination of academics. A lot of the academic folks are the ones who are actually developing a lot of the pieces that we can use in these models. The practitioners from other agencies, whether they're from Phoenix area or the Seattle area or some of the cities in California, are the ones like myself and my staff who apply these models. Consultants are the ones who do a lot of the actual implementation. So we have a nominee list. We're working to finalize that list. And then, as you folks may recall last time, when we released the actual regional forecast, the range forecast, we will have experts review that as well. And so that is the scope of expert panels. There is some overlap in membership. Dennis, he is going to be your staff facilitator for those panels, and they'll have invited lists and a schedule and things like that over the next year or so. The other thing we've done, and this is new, we've worked closely with Ted and Melissa and others in the agency to, frankly, just put a little more formality and structure around this situation already existing. Several times today I've cited the fact that we coordinate closely with cities and counties in the region to do all the work that we're talking about. And we have a list of sort of the usual suspects, the folks that our staff know to call if we are looking at tax laws in Hillsborough, or what's going on in Hillsborough, for example, or what's going on in Washington County or Clackamas County. And they tend to be the same people who get called again and again. And they tend to be the people who work for the people who sit on the MTAC. And so what we decided to do was let's just constitute them as an advisory group. They're not going to make decisions, but they're going to give Metro staff advice. And frankly, they're going to give us lots of information and data from their agencies and get back from us just lots of the technical details that folks normally review and have historically reviewed the way that Metro has done land use planning in the region. So the idea is that essentially the group will convey its advice to MTAC so it fits cleanly into our existing plan structure, and I'll be sort of the main reporter to MTAC. But Mary Beth Todd, who she had to go actually do some of the hard work on the models, but she's going to be the facilitator there, so we're dividing labor up fairly reasonably. I'm going to be one of the primary folks that you'll see talking about this as we go through the process, but my folks are going to talk to you just as well to them. So, people wanted to bring this to your attention because I know that you folks have constituents all throughout the region who speak to you about these things. I just want you to know that there's another group now tucking into MTAC to help us. The idea is also, frankly, to have a standing schedule set in advance so we don't have to struggle to get the information exchange so that folks know what their roles are in advance. It's clear that they're giving us advice rather than making decisions. It's clear that we're exchanging information. They're going to see certain things. And then MTEC's going to have its role and so on. So just making what was a de facto arrangement a little more clear.
So there wasn't a land use technical advisory group per se before? It was more ad hoc?
From my perception, it was more ad hoc. And as I said, we're really going to be talking to the same people the people who replaced the people we talked to before. But now we're just giving it a name and giving it an agenda and giving it a meeting schedule in advance. You're going to come in these days. We've worked with Ted and Rebecca to coordinate the work plan you saw in February with these things and make sure it's all taken over efficiently. So. And then this is a switch now. As Ted narrated to you recently, the process and the decision you make will be structured a little bit differently this time around. And I just wanted to kind of give you a preview and get your thoughts, if you'd like, on the types of information that you could see as we head towards 2018. So clearly, many of the things that are in the existing draft, or excuse me, the existing adopted urban growth report will still be there, so you can see that. The change that we have proposed is that instead of sort of having a binary question, as I think that you're going to have different possible scenarios for alternatives. I use the word alternative, but I know that Councilor Harrington asked for some definitions on that. I've got a slide to propose a definition in a moment. But you actually have options, and the task for us then is to convey you information that lets you weigh the different options. And to do that, we want to know what assumptions we make. What are the market assumptions about things like construction costs and capitalization rates? What are the policy assumptions, or at least the policy information we've encoded that our local colleagues have given us? So that's all crystal clear. You see a result, it's based on some inputs that are these things. So here's the suggested definition. In my practice, we forecasters have tended to call something a scenario when there is a defined set of inputs to the model that is for one thing, we're going to run through the model, we're going to get some forecast results. But we do a lot of those things. We do those all the time. We test model sensitivity, we test models for function, we test models for research purposes. And so we're running scenarios a lot. Mm-hmm. So my proposal is that an alternative is a scenario that you folks have identified that you want to be tested. So the decision makers have said, okay, here's a scenario that we are interested in. Test that, please. And so in this definition, all alternatives are scenarios, but not all scenarios are alternatives. So hopefully that is simple. Maybe not. But Councilor Harrington did ask for some proposals, so there it is.
Sorry that she missed that.
Yeah.
All alternatives are.
And so here's an example pulled straight out of the current urban growth report.
Wow.
This is sort of the old way of doing things. As I said, there's a binary question. There's a certain amount of demand, a certain amount of capacity, you know, good or not. Rather than stating that, though, we will have alternatives to compare. And so, as you may recall, during the multi-criterion evaluation tool presentation, we showed some transportation-related alternative evaluation metrics in graphs that do what I call head-to-head comparisons. So how does alternative A do versus alternative B? And we talked earlier about validating the model and its price estimation. The idea is that we would produce, for this is a, just for you folks to respond to, a graph that says, okay, we got the reference scenario, which is something like in the case of UGB questions, no expansion. You've got different alternatives that, in this case, the cities will propose because they've done their concept planning, and we've talked and agreed to package all the various cities things together in some way. Alternative A, alternative B, that grew. The number of those for their music in general. If you folks would get a graph that says, okay, basically, things in alternative A are more expensive in the future. So that gives you an information. And then, of course, there's other pieces of information that you're used to seeing that seem useful. Forward. This is just a list of what seems to my staff and I to be kind of the big ticket items. This isn't exhaustive. The price indices, you saw a mock-up of that that we might be able to bring you. Clearly, the number of housing units and the amount of commercial space, the capture rate, what is the UGB actually taking in the future relative to the full forecast area, which is the 7 counties. What's the single-family multifamily split? What are the tender rates, ownership versus rental? And how much is occurring in redevelopment versus redevelopment? And again, we would, our thought is to package these in sort of those comparative tables and graphs so you have a quick reference. So, okay, alternative A versus alternative B, there it is. So that really is, again, very speculative, but we do, of course, want the information to be useful when it gets to you, so a little bit of preview and discussion on that would help us help you.
Question.
That's really my last thing. I see a question. So
clarification right there. Residential tenure rates as a ratio?
Can I call him Dennis? How do we typically... tenure is either... adds up to 100%, so
yeah.
Typically, over the last 40 years, we've seen 60% ownership and 40% rental.
Okay.
And that number has been very, very steady,
yeah.
Give or take.
So that's the ratio between ownership and rental.
Yeah, and the sum of the two is 100%.
So part of the reason we're here is we're starting to sort of design the visuals that you will see, and so that could be what, a stack bar chart. 100%
by as much. One of the things that occurs to me again, as it has quite often as I go through this whole thing, answering the question, do we have enough land for housing, is complicated and complex, subject to interpretation, subject to all kinds of analysis. Determining whether or not we have enough industrial land, it seems to me, is like a quantitative leap more complicated than that, because it involves just identifying base prices, availability, it just seems to me that that's almost too complicated to be able to do. Now, we can design a computer program to replicate a nuclear explosion. I suspect that you could probably design a program that would replicate that. But how does that work, and how are we going to display it? Because for everybody that I hear coming to us saying we have not allowed enough land for expansion of the housing supply, I get buffeted with a bunch of people who say we've not allowed enough land for industrial growth.
Hear that in my district.
And quite a bit in your district. And I don't know how to demonstrate. Well, first of all, I don't know what enough land is, quite frankly. Theoretically, you can't have enough, but at one level of theory. But I don't know, how do we analyze that, and how are we going to display it, I guess, are the two questions.
Well, I'll give you a general answer, and then if I may ask Dennis for something else. In the first case, we have some historical information,
20 years at this point.
So we, the answer, frankly, all of our forecast models are based on past behavior. That's just the way our field works.
Wow.
So we try to, as best we can, understand the market decisions that produce the past results and build those into our models and let them sort of make similar decisions in the future. So the history is part of the answer. If the region has done that in the past, it gives us some track record with which to make a forecast. The other part of the answer, though, is that there are, particularly in commercial cases, in my perception of this region, a lot of this comes out of the debate about large lots, right? There are these sort of outlier events. We attract the next Intel, or we attract the next Nike. Well, frankly, we can't really forecast those. Those are the product of an immense amount of effort, frankly, by folks like yourselves who go out and really persuade firms to come here. And so there's a certain amount of just frankly assumptions we would have to make about them. And then to answer the last part of your question, how do we visualize it? You know, we will have to show, as I said, information about how much additional commercial space we're creating over the starting point for year 2015. And so you'll see that as an output, where you know this scenario is going to produce this many thousands or millions of square feet of commercial industrial space, and this other scenario will produce a different amount of that. That may not be wonderfully satisfying, but Dennis, do you want to?
I think the biggest problem is not commercial, but industrial.
Industrial.
And because commercial generally absorbs small tax flows.
Yeah.
There are, although you can talk about malls and so forth, generally we're not creating large scale malls anymore in this region. It's the industrials, large industrials, as Jeff pointed out, it's that idiosyncratic choice that a product manager might decide to place their plant here in Portland. And we do a fine job of forecasting the trend, that is the baseline trend, like you have 200 more lumber wood product workers in the next 10 years. We do fine with that. But where we run into trouble is, what if Applied Materials wanted to enter this market back in 1999 and wanted 300 acres?
Yep.
I could not have predicted that. But how do we come up with that answer or that task? Well, it's because our economic development officials in this region back in 1999 hustled around and was able to make the case to Applied Materials product manager that they might want to locate here. But having said that, we didn't have 300 acres at that time in contiguous tax lots. So that's the problem with industrial, large-scale industrial, is contiguous pieces. And I know this council attempted to address this in 2004, when Dick Vanderpump wrote some of the wording for some of the UGB amendments for preserving large lots. So that's not a modeling solution. That's actually more of a value solution, best handled from economic development and policy development.
Well, I guess maybe, and what that speaks to is perhaps a different group of technicians than the ones that would be dealing with the question of, well, do we have enough land for housing? I agree with Dennis. I mean, commercial pretty much takes care of itself. We began out in Hillsborough, we were beginning to hear that there were not enough large lots for big boxes. And I promptly told everybody that would listen that there was no way any political figure in the entire greater Portland metropolitan area was going to go to bat for expanding the urban growth boundary to allow more big boxes. That was not something that anybody would do. So suck it up and find a place to put them.
Never seen anybody with a sign that said more Walmart.
Yeah. Sometimes more Walmart, but that's a different concept, I think. But I think it's really, really hard because it is idiosyncratic. Even down to the 25 lot or 25 acre lot and the kinds of enterprises that would go on those lots, it's a question of whether you can get them. I mean, it's a question of whether you can get them, and that's a question of whether you've got a place to put them. And balancing that is really tough. I think it's probably one of the more artistic as opposed to scientific portions of what we do here.
If I may just point out on that theme that it's considered in the forecast world perfectly legitimate if you've got the collective, you know, public and the region and private sector plus public sector have something in the works that has, you know, is under discussion, it's legitimate to say, okay, we can make that as an assumption, we can see that as a scenario. So that's one way that folks, our peer agencies, have treated this.
But, you know, for example, if for example, we decided that the collective economic development professionals in the region decided that there was an opportunity for us to recruit additional software manufacturers up from the Bay Area, for example, to locate up here, what kind of sites would they need? Well, we had two within a year's period of time that came up. One was one located in a high-rise glass and aluminum facility out in Hillsboro, and the other one located in an old warehouse in downtown Portland. They're almost exactly the same size companies. They engage in almost exactly the same kind of work. And it just depended on what the folks who were leading that company wanted.
And this is a place where the economic value atlas can, when we get that on its feet, can help us answer just those questions.
Yep.
And in our view, that's a valuable exercise because that really is taking what we call, in this case, performance monitoring information, but it's really about the economy. What's the economy doing? What's the workforce doing? And having that information at our disposal to inform those discussions.
Yeah. Go ahead, Sam. Sir.
Well, I'm just trying to get a handle and understanding on the scenarios versus alternatives versus possible versus forecasting. So I guess here's a scenario that was real life that that brought some things to light to me, which was, so we went through population and employment projections, right? And I depend on the most scientific analysis. A lot of assumptions have to be made, but they're done in the most kind of scientific way we possibly can. You know, data and information that are collected by folks who are not necessarily bringing or trying not to bring their bias to the table in doing that. A lot of folks are frustrated with that process, but to me, that's actually been a pretty accurate number over time. I think we're seeing, at least with the population growth. Then, and so that tells me that something's going right there. A lot of folks were frustrated with that because they said, you know, that's not, you know, we should assume that there's going to be more population growth. Well, let's aspire to more population growth. That's what we want. I actually might argue with that a little bit. But let's aspire for that. Let's aspire for a higher level of employment. But let's not, you know, what we were calling then cook the books and changing the assumptions. And so, to me, if we are we talking about a scenario where we're picking alternate assumptions that would change those scientific analysis about projections and forecasting, or are we talking about changing? Because we're talking about let's you know factor in that we'd like to be at this population growth, or we'd like to be in, and see what decisions we would need to make differently. But I guess I'm opening the door toward let's take this, you know, alternative fact or that alternative fact because we like the forecast and projection. I mean, I guess just wanting to be certain we're not getting into that territory, which I'm...
That was an excellent question.
We've done that.
I should have put it in the sort of the original slide. I'm sorry, I didn't do it. My answer to that is that our working assumption as the analysts supporting your process is that we're really doing what some agencies call the current policies. So we are not making aspirational assertions. We are saying, okay, given our best knowledge of what the economy has done up till now and how people behave in this region, we are going to say, given the policy inputs that are demonstrably, you know, in play, here's what the future is likely to be given our best science. And that is consistent with forecasting practices. You know, Metro, it does the corridor planning for the corridors, right? When you're going to FTA, that's pretty much what they expect you to do. You know, you do have some license from FDA to say, okay, we have some aspirations to get more development around the transit corridor in question. And if you can make some case to them that you are empowered or are about to enable those things in reality, you can then sort of analyze that scenario. But generally, the expectation in the field to make a decision where the absolute numbers matter, how many transit riders are you going to have, you know, how much UGB expansion do we need, what's the traffic and revenue from the toll facility and transportation? You know, the absolute numbers matter. Right? The general practice is to say, okay, we're not going to make aspirational assumptions unless there is some demonstrable case that they can become ill. But that really is also a choice that, you know, decision makers can make.
Well, so, I guess I'm looking at forecast single family versus multifamily split by scenario. So, are we talking about what we would forecast that future to be and having alternatives for what we would forecast that future to be? Or are we saying we would have some alternates on what we'd like that future to be? So I guess, you know, I think there's pretty good science in terms of what's the breakdown of single family versus multifamily likely to be. And people have very strong opinions on what they want it to be. So I
think that's an output.
Yeah,
so we're not talking about giving people a choice about and sort of having a debate about and having decision makers and sort of political world deciding and weighing in on what they think that forecasting should be.
If I can just help it, then you fill in. But I think when Ted presented, he talked about like we would model, let's just say scenario A would be no UGB expansion. And then scenario B might be, what would happen if you expanded the UGB to include all the land that has approved concept plans in urban reserves? Is that fair?
Yeah.
Okay.
Again,
and so he would produce an output that told you in scenario A, this is what the results are.
Yes.
And then scenario B, this is what the outputs are. And then you as a council could make a decision about
which you like
better.
Yes.
Like
yes. Yeah. And that's right. And Martha summarized it very well. So the alternatives are defined not by what these numbers are, but by what the inputs are.
Right.
If five cities have five concept plans and add, I'll just say, 1,000 total acres to the UGB from, you know, established reserves, we could package this together and we'll call that scenario A. And perhaps there's some discussion with the city, maybe there's someone who has a concept plan that, I'm making this up, okay, that's maybe not quite ready, but you want to test that. What if we let them finish that and we adopt that? Well, that might be scenario B. And then we make the assumption that people will continue to behave the way they have historically in terms of developers and homebuyers and, you know, business agents who lease commercial space in industrial space. And we'll make assumptions that will show you what construction costs, and we'll run the numbers, and these things will be outputs. And you'll see them, and you'll get to compare them. And that's where the value judgment comes in. As President Hughes pointed out, there is, frankly, in my professional opinion, some subjectivity to the question of, do we have enough land? Do we have enough land at a certain price point? Do we have enough land to enable, you know, multifamily or single family? And our job is to say, okay, if you provide these conditions, this is what we think is likely to happen. It's, in my view, your job is to say, okay, we find those conditions acceptable. And you make the choice, this versus that. Does that help?
I think it does. I think that allowing us to look at the scenarios is great, and I think the different scenarios and being conscious that we're looking at scenarios that we are creating and that we're not simply just changing the inputs and then making decisions based on those changes. I think you've answered my question.
Other questions?
So my general question to you folks, please, is just really, you know, do you have any questions or concerns or suggestions about what you've heard? Is there something that you need more information on so that if your constituents start asking you questions, you're prepared? Is there suggestions you have for us as we were planning staff to actually craft all the details? And this is, as I said, a little bit speculative right now. We're improving the tools and looking at what we can produce for alternatives analysis. Just, you know, so any feedback would be welcome on any of those topics.
I just had a housekeeping suggestion. Jeff, when I checked in on the weekend, this PowerPoint presentation wasn't available online. One of our members is not here. I don't know how to get this off of this platform and into an emailable format. So if you can pass it around by email to us,
that'd
be very helpful. I thought it was helpful to have these slides in front of us.
I agree, particularly the ones about what are the enhancements, what is the technical outreach that's anticipated, so people understand that this isn't happening in a closed loop in this building.
Good idea.
Right. You know, it's one of these hope springs eternal things, I guess, about me, but I still have some confidence that the earlier that we share, that we vet the process with our partners, the more buy-in we will get. That has not proven to be the case, but I like it as a theory, and I think it would be a good thing to move forward with. I guess my only suggestion is that that on the industrial side, and I don't know if there's any need to think about it in terms of commercial side at all, but I do think that maybe on the industrial side, that part of the vetting be with folk who are in the business of, of doing that kind of construction, and who are the ones that I always hear from that we haven't provided enough. The other question I guess I have is, how will the, assuming that it's available in the short future, is there a way that we can incorporate the economic values atlas information into the analysis?
That's a great idea. I actually did. Have you heard that it's a consultant or contract firm? I don't know. I'll have to bring back and answer that. We've been talking, my staff, have been talking with Jeffrey Raper and his folks about that. The last time we coordinated, they hadn't actually got the bookings under.
It seems to me it would be at least good to share it with our local partners as they prepare their concept plan, particularly if they're going to bring in industrial land. But even, and there's even some implications for where you might locate residential property in terms of shortening commutes and that sort of thing. But anyway, I'm really excited about that product, and so I hope we can make the best use of it.
Based on your comment, the fact that influences where industrial land is put is geography. And then, of course, there's the transportation that supports that. So, I assume that your model doesn't involve geography. Is there like topography, things that are a description on building, how hilly, the hillside, obviously flatland is more desirable than a hillside.
Well, let me answer the part of that question I can directly speak to, and then I might call on them to get for some detailed support. In terms of transportation accessibility, the land use models do take inputs from travel models. So we forecast future transportation system performance, and we transfer the results of that in what we call accessibility data to the land use models. So land that is more accessible is essentially more desirable, whether it's commercial or residential. And then the question of specific sort of site characteristics.
Site characteristics are generally, Councilor, site characteristics are generally embedded in the zoning. So you never see industrial zoning on a 20% slope.
You should. You shouldn't.
No, you should. And in fact, they do a pretty good job. I think our local planning department do a really good job of citing industrial zones. That is, something that's supposed to be industrial will be cited in, they'll take into account environmental features, but oftentimes there are conflict. So a lot of places that are flat are also it's sort of swampy. Just make it be flat. And oftentimes they're adjacent to waterways because industrial tends to be a harsh activity, and putting it next to water where other people and things, human habitation is not really in conflict is often the case. So we see a lot of our industrial land zone, a lot of adjacent to our waterways. And flat areas, which happen to be floodplain prevalent. So, but they are flat. So you don't see anything industrial or even commercial, high-density commercial, in 20% slope or more. You know, you'll hear developers say, well, the land that's left over is highly constrained, so on and so forth. And it's because it has. We have a finite supply, and those places that are the most desirable have already been developed. And now we're looking at redeveloping some things. So brownfield remediation is probably particularly important. As we know, that there's a lot of issues with those too.
So I think in summary, the zoning is part of the answer, but the local, this is the case with local review, is going to be important.
Not as much our responsibility as it
is. Yeah, so the buildable lands inventory process, as we mentioned earlier, is going to reduce an estimate of the likely. I didn't dwell on it, partly because my team and I are working on the housing side of the models right now, but the new estimate of potential capacity includes commercial and industrial capacity, and then we'll do that, and then that will go out for review again, so we can make that to be sure that we're looking for those things as well.
Okay. Do you feel like you've gotten any answers to your question?
Yes, thank you. I've heard that clearly there is a lot of interest in exactly how the industrial calculations are done. I hear that your constituents are asking you more than the usual questions, perhaps, about the industrial side of the equation, so we need to be careful to be sure that we're looking at that as we validate the models and provide information for you. I heard very clearly that we need to be sure that we are doing through good science and summarize Councillor Chase's points, be sure we are doing forecasts that are clearly supportable by past performance, observed behaviors, policies that are identified. We need to get Councillor Harrington's presentation.
Or the rest of us too.
Yeah, just give us
useful question as to whether the economic value out of this is going to be ready in time to help inform some of these topics and inform sort of perhaps the review that we talked about. I mean, we need to be careful to sort of cross our T's and dot our I's when we're looking at the potential capacity of the industrial designated lands and be sure that we're doing that thoroughly. I also heard we need to be clear as we proceed always to let people know how the process works, where we are in it, and what certain steps do versus what other steps do, just so we're not confusing people.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's back to where we are again. Here's the legislative update. Let's take could we do a quick bio break, maybe? Let's go plan the day. We'll reconvene. Well, everybody's settling down, by the way. I have a request for a thumbs up on a authorization to represent Merck and Metro at a trade mission. Fact-finding, it's basically a FAM. It's one of those things that we do where we also like to get everybody to give me a... There you go. Thank you. Now. Oh, yeah, we do the wedge because then everybody can see the screens. Oh, didn't you guys do it backwards?
The wedge is going the wrong way.
You got it backwards.
Nice idea, but not quite there yet. Martha, you have a great profile.
I've got
to look
right here.
Yeah. First time I've noticed that they went wrong today. That's why I feel so lonely up here. Because I got this big white space.
Well, I was moved around this way during Jeff's presentation.
Yeah,
it
worked out.
So, Andy.
So we scheduled a series of these updates or briefings, knowing the transportation package is going to get more and more, hopefully, firm together and have more discussion about where things are heading. had a session a couple weeks ago. Last week gave an update more on all the bills, having passed the bill deadline, and updated you on what's still alive and what has fallen by the wayside on general policy. Thought today we spent a little time updating on yesterday's JPAC lobby day. I'd be happy to do some of that, so there were three counselors there as well. And then thought we'd talk a bit more about where things are with the state transportation package, in particular the surcharge language supporting our region is bringing to the package specifically, if that's okay with you. Unless there were questions about any bills or policy issues we talked about last week, or things you've heard about in other listings you've heard about that I didn't update on last week. Great. So we had about a dozen JPAC members down yesterday for a series of meetings, largely with members of the Transportation Legislative Work Group or Legislative Committee, and then members of our delegation, and then a luncheon with folks we couldn't get individual meetings with. And so we had meetings with as well.
Windows and lunch.
Yeah, that's good. But kind of had a roundtable discussion about the transportation package and issues. I thought it was a very productive morning and afternoon with legislators. Learned a good deal, I think, about the strength of support for the overall state package and a few, you know, issues that we need to work on. Probably the biggest lesson was the members of the legislative committee have a sense of what's going on and sort of have a sense of the shape and direction of the package. But members outside are just hearing we're doing a package and have some sense of the elements of it, but don't really have an appreciation of deeper issues. Was the sense that I took away. So we've got work to do to normalize the ideas that are in the package with the broader legislative members who aren't on the transportation committee or aren't in leadership. Other reflections on the meetings we had. We had a good debrief in JPEGs. Get some issues around Southwest Corridor to work on. The only piece of the package that we're asking for on Southwest Corridor is $150 million on for the lottery funding, and that's a very heavily subscribed funding source for limited capacity in this session. So that's a tougher ask unless there's an ability to create more capacity in lottery bond funding.
That's one where the speaker was very discouraging.
Mm-hmm. More generally on the project, the speaker was discouraging, so we have some work to do at that leadership level. We have really good meetings with other leadership in the House, Williamson and others, who are huge proponents of Southwest Corridor. So.
Okay. Senator Byer could be our lead cheerleader for the whole thing, for the whole, not necessarily Southwest Corridor, but for the entire transportation package.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of comment about how important it was that the region hang together, that we brought them a message of unity early on, and that was critical in moving the package to where it is. That folks generally understand the surcharge concept. We had some interesting meeting with one of the co-chairs where he has not been a part of that particular work group, but didn't know the fundamentals of the surcharge, even working on the maintenance subcommittee. So just a lesson, I think, for the lobby team in particular to make sure we're still talking to everybody about all the elements. I guess it's less than the downside of the work group process. Folks honed in on either transit safety, the multimodal maintenance piece, or congestion. So the members of those committees all got deep dives into those issues, but didn't necessarily keep up with all the details of the other committees they didn't serve on. Even though they reported out to the full committee, not all those details are stuck in their brain. So some work to do there to make sure they're getting it. Timing-wise, we got also a little bit of a mixed message. Byer, I think, was very sure that they were going to have a bill on the House floor by the end of May, and then into and through the Senate in early to mid-June. Others said this is all going to pass the third week of June. So not quite clear what the timing is, but I don't think we're going to see a bill being debated in the legislative committee probably until at least the third week of May or so. So still some time for us to be helping shape the contents of that bill, but there's a lot of advocacy and discussion going on.
Sure.
Well, the lottery fund ask seems to be the weakest part of this package. So what might be some options? I mean, we can't get that money for Southwest Corridor. How would that change things? What might be other options?
So certainly, come back in another session in a couple of years, depending on how that affects the overall project. I think the immediate request is to increase the amount of capacity that they would borrow under the lottery fund. That has implications for other state borrowing, the state makes other mechanisms, but there's a lot of interest from a lot of parties in getting some access to those bonded capital dollars. So that's an option for this session. There's the option of waiting a couple of sessions. There's the option of asking for more money in 18 bond measure. They could have applications for, you know, more local match that's required to be raised. There's many steps to the South Dakota Water funding process.
Or be willing to, if we were to be offered a smaller amount this year, take it, but then go back again next year and ask for the remainder then and get the amount we need over time. Because as long as we're looking at major expenditures for construction and whatnot, not starting before, 2021. So if we could get it anywhere in that timeline, then that would be helpful. So one of the messages I've had there, people say, well, there's so many burdens on lottery dollars now. And I've pointed out that many of those are new asks, whereas to support capital transit projects is a historic use for those funds, and asking the state to maintain that historic provision for coming from those funds.
I think you also made the point that most other states have some part of their state budget devoted to transit capital.
Well, and just transit in general,
right.
Whereas the state of Oregon has always chosen not to do that. But this is the place, one place, where the state itself has helped support municipal transit.
And, of course, the Orange Line had a $250 million contribution from the lottery fund.
Which was half as long as...
Less on this one. This one's an even more expensive project. Yeah. Much longer in terms of distance.
Sam, go ahead.
Could you talk a little about the employee payroll tax and how much it's tied to the success of the other pieces of the package, whether there's a floor on it, and what other folks are looking for to fund?
Yeah. So the discussion that came out of the transit work group was a proposal for a 0.1% payroll tax, and it sounds like they're focusing on the employee side, whereas the payroll tax in our region was on the employer side, and then going up to 0.82%.
Is it part of the same bill?
It will be part of it. There will probably be a few different bills, but it would be part of the transportation proposal overall, yes. The tax increases might get bundled together. I think it's indeed a more supermajority vote on that piece. So the discussion, as you recall, when folks run the state, the governor's visioning panel, the legislative committee, they heard support for transit operations funding from across the state. So there's an underlying support for doing something. The transit and safety committee went through a long list of potential revenue sources and looked at each one and sort of, you know, set aside those ones that are either super challenging politically or just didn't raise that much money or were oversubscribed or administratively tough, and came back to the payroll tax after all of that work. And even though there are objections on both ends, on with the idea of an employee tax, there are employee organizations saying, hey, you know, some of our folks are at the lowest end of the wage scale and you're going to put, you know, another burden on them. And on the business side, folks saying, hey, you know, for some of us, we're going to pick up this tab. We're not going to pass that cost on to our employees who face the tax in the business. So you're hearing some complaints from every side. I think it raises about $107 million a year. So it's a pretty significant amount of money. For many areas, it would be the new funding they don't have much in the way. And we've heard a variety of uses of being envisioned in different areas. Some want to purchase buses, so it's capital. Some want to enhance service, create a bunch of shuttles or clean cities. And what we're hearing in the metro area is trying to avoid use the money to support first the low-income fare program, and then bus service enhancement, and then think about some form of additional service for businesses that feel like they are large contributors to the payroll tax now, but don't feel like their employees get a lot of service. And so it's trying to figure out some way to provide some additional service and service enhancement specialized for those types of businesses. It could be some kind of shuttle service, unclear what that is. But those are the three things that we've heard as elements that would be considered in this region. We heard from legislators in our tattles around yesterday a lot of interest in some clarity from TriMet about what those expenditures would be in exchange for support for enacting a payroll tax. So it sounds like there's statewide less of a concern. In our region, there are listeners from our region want to hear what exactly you're going to spend it on, as opposed to just here's more money, go do good stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's the flavor we're getting. We had heard there were a lot of business organizations in the metro area who were initially just flat out opposed to more payroll taxes. Sounds like that's softening a bit, as long as there can be a discussion about what's the benefit coming out of it. And I know there's ongoing discussions with employee organizations and others about how to make it palatable. Right now, I think both are also saying we want a floor and one ceiling. So people are coming at both angles. That's administratively costly and challenging. You spend a lot of money to take for employers to say, do they pay, do they not pay, you know, when you kick that in, as opposed to just flat percentage plan where everybody pays it. There's no cost to do that. So there are people doing analysis also of what is the real impact, and the data we've been hearing is for the lowest paid employees, the cost per week is less than the cost of a bus fare. It's what people are saying. I haven't actually seen those figures, but so at that 0.1% rate, it's something, but it's less than that cost. And then if you're tying that to a low income fare, the creation of a low income fare program, then you can also create some benefit for the poorest. So that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I do think. It was something in the range of $40 million a year coming back to this region, or that would come into TriMet, maybe more than that to the region, and then TriMet getting about $40 million a year.
Just doing basic math on population, and that sounds about right, out of about 100 million, 40% or so in this region. But the distribution formula is the other discussion folks are having. We have a much higher per capita wage here, so if you just do straight payroll tax and distribute it based on population, we lose out. We send money out of the region to other countries. So there's a discussion going on what's a fair distribution formula of that money as well.
I hear from different groups, from the employees, unions that are really concerned about taxing employees further, even if it's $2 a month. A lot of those folks don't necessarily take low income fare, but it's helpful to understand the administrative costs, and then there's the reinvesting it back into low income programs, and probably the low income fare, I think is a great option for that. That would probably then take about a quarter of it. And then increasing fare and frequency and the number of routes would probably be more amenable to lower income communities. I think if you get into employees paying for services, for particular employers or particular regions, that might, I think, complicate it a little more. And if you get into, and then I think you could see a scenario where, whenever you have an ongoing source, people want to bond it out, and that could be a solution for, potentially the corridor. I think that would also probably create challenges for some of the more progressive folks that are still having a challenging time getting on board because of the employee, that's what I'm hearing. So,
and the challenge here is, we don't have a bill in front of us yet, because it's all been in the work groups and the proposed, and now there's just discussions floating about, and people are, trying to take positions on something that's not, written down with clarity.
And then that would be tied. That would be one component of a bill, or it would be its own bill.
It'll likely be part of a larger package. There may be a few vehicles that move pieces along, but I suspect because it's a revenue piece, it'll be tied in with the other revenue pieces.
Okay. My, just I guess to close out my comment on this, I mean, my perspective for the Low Income Fair Task Force community, which has said they want to go, you know, and really advocate for the Low Income Fair program, is to really focus on the value of that program rather than getting too wrapped up in all of the dynamics of something that's not even taking shape yet. So.
You asked also about the connection back to the larger package, and I guess the extra comment I would make is everyone is viewing the transit operations piece as an integral part of the overall package. They've heard loud and clear it needs to be a balanced multimodal package, and so as challenging as some of the issues are around the payroll tax, everyone's still saying we're committed to a package that includes road money and transit money, safe routes to schools, as balanced as we can make it. So it's glued into the package from that point of view. And you start losing some key supporters of the transportation package, and that piece falls off somehow. It's a sense of, well, you've got to make this work with the package side.
Right.
Thanks. It certainly seemed to me that legislators that we met with, including around the lunch table, were favorably impressed with the sight of a united group of local, regional folks coming to the table from TriMet and Metro to local governments, JPAC, and non-JPAC members who were also there. It underscored for me that, you know, less than 2 weeks ago, we were still very far apart from TriMet in terms of when we go to the ballot and what we look at on the ballot, and we heard from leadership of the Transportation Committee that they're more interested in the 2018 election in this region than the 2020 election, but they are interested in making sure that between the surcharge and the size of the package that we would take the voters here, there would be resources to do additional things. We, to keep that coalition together, we're going to have to start doing some planning around active transportation safety, I think, as a component of a complete package. Both in terms of how surcharge resources get spent in our region and how we fashion the 2018 measure, and keeping in close communication with our partners, including TriMet, is going to be very important and potentially challenging. I know just seeing the different reactions to the question, why do we have a list of active transportation projects in the handouts? There seems to be a lot of volatility around the table, or potential volatility. I don't want the Mayor of Wilsonville to be opposed to having active transportation projects in a package because of a reaction from the Senator to the optics of having a long list of potential projects in our handouts, but that did happen at the lunch table.
So, in the pack of handouts, we brought right up the South Corridor from that TriMet we worked on, and right up from ODOT on the bottling projects, and a right up that we had been working for some time with our partners on about active transportation projects. That last one was meant to be illustrative of three different sized packages, and it's also meant to really be about the if we have resources out of the package that come to the region, what are some of the kinds of choices we might make? We're in between a rock and a hard place. We're hearing from some folks, what would you use with your money? And we're hearing from Senator Johnson yesterday, don't bring me a big list of products you want in this transportation package, because she took it as, oh, we want you to fund these as well, almost like earmarks or something like that. So it's a tricky spot where some legislators are saying, I want to see what kind of things you're going to do with either your 50-30-20 money, or with, if you have a surcharge surplus with those surplus funds, and others who are more in the mode of trying to put the votes together and trying to, you know, make the package not lard it up.
Keep it simple.
Yeah, so it's a hard thing to have lists of projects for one purpose and yet not get confused with a second purpose.
Yeah.
We did both.
Yeah. I think we were successful in clarifying for Senator Johnson why that description of what we could do for active transportation was in the packet, and that is not anticipated as being part of the specific state bill.
The pressure that they're under is they've crafted the bones of a package, yeah. And everybody is saying, oh, and my bridge, oh, and my road, oh, and my transit, oh, and my airport, oh, so they're under this constant pressure, and she sees this list.
Don't bring us another list of things that we have to broke.
So clarity is our friend.
both clarity of speaking and listening.
Yes.
Well,
yes. Yes.
We can only control our speaking.
I understand. Sure.
Well, I want to say thank you to you and you and all the staff that helped organize it.
And Beth.
The coordination session. It felt really successful to me, and I know we talked briefly about maybe doing this again in this legislative session and as strategic time and work on people that try to get people there that would help us. You know.
And we were thinking when a bill has been introduced and when there's time for there to be reaction to it, then we would target specific individuals to go down and talk to help clarify.
So, moving from the lobby experience and the act itself, we've been working amongst regional partners for some time in developing language to propose to legislative council. And we've been invited by Senator Boquist, the head of the congestion committee, to help their legislative council get it right from our perspective. So, we've been drafting up surcharge language, and Homey's been helping. TriMet has sort of started the draft. We've made edits back and forth. The basic concept is you're in that concept, we'd be using the urban growth boundary, or suggesting the urban growth boundary as the boundary in which you have an extra gas tax and registration fee. Those taxes are blank in the bill, as is common with these kind of building enforcement. The concept is you would require the in this area a congestion improvement program, and define the kinds of things that could fit within that pretty broad definition, just anything within the constitutional limitation of gas tax and registration fee. Require the local decision makers to develop that congestion improvement program. The money would be collected by ODOT. They could get reimbursed for collection costs, stick it into a state account of some sort, and then when the decision is made locally for programming, that have the money go off to the appropriate jurisdiction. It could be straight back to ODOT if it's bonding for a bottleneck. It could be off to the Gresham for a roadway project, et cetera, et cetera. And then the real question that we talked about a couple times becomes the governance question, and who exactly is allocating those funds. Oh, one other issue we worked on was there has to be some administrative piece wrapped around it that says what determines the process, notice, public input, appeal rights, that kind of thing. And at first there was a suggestion that let's roll it up to the OTC and direct them to establish regulations around it, but then we worked on saying, no, we actually have a regulatory process through the MTIP process that's laid out in federal regulations and rules. Let's just refer to that as what governs this local process. So not sort of leaving it open to a future process that's unknown and not controlled at the regional table. So the final major question is this the MPO? Is this JPACT with Metro Council acting? Or is it just JPACT decision action within the context of the MPO? I think it's been reported in some past sessions, there are some difference of opinion amongst some of our partners. And what we really want to be able to do is stay arm in arm locked down in Salem, promoting something that we think the region can propose. So the staff have been having this discussion, a nice, lively discussion amongst ourselves, but decided that's not an appropriate place for this decision to get made. Initially, I suggested that maybe Craig, as the chair of JPAC, could call around to the JPAC members, have them get briefed on the language and the approach, and try to get some sense of consensus. Since then, there's been a meeting put together later this Friday with some key decision makers around the JPAC table to try to have a discussion about this piece, and I think we thought we'd talk about that a little bit more. We put together a little chart that talks about what are the various ways we allocate funds right now, and how does that how do state, regional, local, and transit district funds flow through the existing MPO, the Metropolitan Transportation Improvement Program, as well as the Regional Transportation Plan? So this chart's intended to show that on the top, you've got state-level decisions on projects in our region that have to be incorporated into our MTIP, and then back incorporated into the state's STIP. You have RFA projects that get determined by JPAC and Metro and are subsequently incorporated into the MTIP. The third box there is this congestion improvement program in Norway. There's the version 1, version 2 governance question there, but still the assurance that all those projects have to get incorporated by JPAC and the Metro Council into the MTIP. Same thing with regional transit projects. Same thing with a lot of city and county projects. The key question is, do any of those projects have a connection to federal funding? If they do, they have to be in the RTP, and they get incorporated into the MTIP. And probably capturing a larger suite of programs, do they have an impact on air quality? Then they need to have an air quality conformity analysis and be incorporated into the MTIP. So this is meant to show we have federal and state requirements to manage and plan for these all these projects in a collaborative fashion through the MPO. So no matter what we do with this congestion improvement program, it's going to have to come through this process at the MPO level. So that's where we are for now. I think we're trying to prep for this conversation on Friday in a way that we can have a productive conversation with partners and establish some level of consensus around how to move forward.
Sure.
You're going to answer. So who are the key people that you're focusing on?
The people who will be in this meeting on Friday. This is actually... this meeting is being actually called by Roy Rogers, who's the one who asked for the meeting. He had approached me last week and asked me to convene such a meeting, to which I replied that I was concerned that if we do that with the state in negotiation between us and TriMet, that TriMet would look askance upon that as my interference in that. So Roy took it upon himself, and I actually appreciate that he did, to approach TriMet and say, we really need to sit down with all our regional partners and discuss what this governance would be, and specifically then, and also talking about the regional bond measure, what should that include and how should that be done. So Roy's invited members will have representatives from each of the counties, I think, will be there. Also several cities will be there as well, myself and Roy and Neil. And at this point, it's only elected officials. There will be no staff there at all from any agency. And so I think it will be a productive conversation. That's one that I actually wanted to have a long time ago, but we haven't had the opportunity to have it until now.
You think it would be a geographic distribution of people?
Absolutely.
So there's always a problem getting somebody from the Portland City Council.
The mayor's been invited, and so we'll see what we get.
It's not going to be legitimate if 600,000 people and their elected representatives haven't had a role in making the decision.
I would agree with that, but they've got to make the choice to want to be engaged.
And we have to make the choice of whether we find that outcome acceptable, given that.
Yeah. But that becomes easier if they participate in the discussion.
Oh, no kidding.
It is, but I do also kind of have concerns that, yes, it's challenging getting Portland engaged, and city council has always been with city. I mean, it's always been with city, Portland city councilors getting them engaged, and there's times where it's better than others. But it's a system problem. There's something in the system that's creating that. That's why it continues to be the same challenge year after year. It's not just this personality or that personality. I know some people step up more, and so it's not consistently that way. But I do think that. You know, if folks just aren't showing up, we have some systematic problems to address rather than sort of just like, well, you know, what can we do that can show up? So, I do think that poses a challenge.
It is a real challenge, and it can be very frustrating to the rest of us. And for whatever the reason is why they aren't there, at some level it's because they choose not to be. They're prioritizing something else ahead of it, or they're not somehow being the information is not getting to them that this is important for them to be engaged in. So I'm not sure how to. I've struggled with this through several Portland administrations. How do we better engage the Portland City Council? and not been able. Every time we get a new mayor, we hear, "Oh yes, I'm going to be part of it. I'll be there." And then for maybe 4 or 6 months, we get that, and then we never see them anymore.
This has actually hasn't taken that long to cycle in.
Yeah.
Sure.
Is Dan's also participating?
The mayor was invited. The mayor was invited.
So I guess the question is more in general is how confident are you in this process of that we're not giving in something that we're comfortable with? I was yesterday when I was people I saw Ryan was with me and made comments that you know this decision hasn't been made yet about who has responsibility, who governs this, and I'm afraid that these are concerned that this could get hijacked.
Well, I think.
I'm confident.
Well, going forward and talking in the meeting when we're discussing what the decision making structure would be, we've determined what it is, what our want would be, what our need would be, and what we would be unable to support. And our desire, our want would be that the surcharge funds are addressed by the full MPO JPAC Metro Council using the same governance structure that we use for all of our other funding in the region. Fallback on that for a need, we would need for the allocation to be by JPAC within the MPO structure, which would mean that would be the staffing would be through the standard JPAC process, my MPO staff and the attorney. Using the existing MTIP process that we use, going through that regulatory structure for the requirements for public notice, of course, involvement, rights of appeal of the public, et cetera, et cetera. And then that it would include in that package, there would be some funding to support that staffing that would need to be done through that for the MPO. What we will be clear that we cannot support would be an allocation of surcharge funds outside the existing JPAC structure, such as some new body or done through the Region 1 Act or advice only by the region to the Oregon Transportation Commission, something like that. That is not something that we would support, and if it were to come down to that, we would be vocal in our opposition to that. Pardon me?
Is Roy supportive?
I think Roy, in general, is very supportive of the JPAC within the MPO structure. I think as he wants to compromise, so us demanding the full MPO might not be something that's achievable. But I think Roy understands Washington County is really successful within the current JPAC process, and I think Roy sees the value of that and how, in fact, my initial conversation with him and indicating that there were those who would prefer something outside of the existing government structure. And his initial reaction was, why would we want that? How would that even work? So I think he's supportive of something closer to the government structure that we have today.
Part of the problem, I think, with Washington County's participation is that Roy has been the guy, and some of his colleagues have not become as familiar with the issues as Roy is. And so the conversation I had with Chair Dyke, for example, he said he thought that just as we would say that something that eliminates JPAC is unacceptable and we'd be vocal about that, he thought that the other side would be vocal if it included JPAC. And I said,
which other side?
Well, that's the folks who are saying that there should be some alternative distribution system. He was saying basically that he didn't want Metro to be involved.
Right.
And I said, Andy. But I said, but you're using our boundaries. And he said, well, no, it's the urban growth boundary. I said, no. That's essentially our boundary, number one. And we're the only agency that has jurisdiction totally within our boundary. So who else would do it?
Well, and I think the point that we can make if the pressure is put on that because those funds would still have to go through the MTIP process, still need to qualify with regard to air quality standards, that if it were to go through a process that didn't include all of that, that in most cases, in most likely cases, it would not qualify for any matching federal funds. Because it wouldn't meet the federal requirements for air quality standard and having gone through that MTIP process, being part of the MTIP.
Right.
So even if there was a separate governance structure that would come up with a list of projects, it would still have to come to the MPO for inclusion into the MTIP and to be evaluated for air quality standard.
And just to say for context, when we started this discussion, it was a discussion about some kind of tri-county surcharge area or maybe a surcharge in the Region 1 Act or some other footprint or the Courts District, which is essentially tri-county. So I think we've come a long way, and potentially, you know, then driven by the Oregon Transportation Commission with some kind of more of act-like recommendation process. So I think we've come a long way from that point to saying, no, it's the urban growth boundary, it's JPAC, at the very least, making this decision. So from that context, with this brand new idea, I don't know that any of we've found any other state that does a surcharge for a smaller area state imposed tax like this. So we're experimenting on that policy side of it. I think as a region, we've done pretty darn well to hang together around using the governance structure that we have in JPAC. I am hearing there's discussions in the other MPOs beginning that are much, much, much earlier level. The state's talking about recreating what we do in other MPO areas. And because they have weaker history of governance like than we do, they're having a very hard time in their other areas deciding what would be appropriate for them. Eugene, apparently in particular, is having a dispute between the county and the LCOG about what the boundary would be, about who would control it. So we're at least further along the path than that we seem to be fine with UGB and using the JPAC structure we have. The question really is the full MPO process we have, or is it JPAC?
But Andy, you know, it isn't all that unique. I mean, most other states fund these kinds of projects with sales tax, and it's not uncommon for them to have a specific sales tax for a specific region, an enhanced sales tax that would...
On the transit side, locally, yes, but not on the highway side. I mean, in Washington, they're doing a state gas tax, Idaho state gas tax, California sends the money down if they enact it at the state level. So for transit, it's true, and we don't have that. We're missing that piece on the
right.
sales tax side,
right.
But we're experimenting on the side of localized highway revenue raising.
I think I'm perfectly comfortable if we had to fall back to the position of JPAC, because we've got three members on JPAC that are members of this council. We staff JPAC, and ultimately whether they have to come back to us for approval or not, and all we can do is either approve or send it back to them, so even our approval is limited now, they still have to come back to us for the RTP and other phases of what gets included. So I mean, I just think we have ample control that we ought not to let the whole project drift away on our insistence that we do it exactly the way we're doing it now.
Yes. So are you hearing any resistance from other people in the region? I know there's resistance to this in other parts of the state.
Not resistance to the concept of surcharge, no. We had discussions with some legislators, and I think there's concerns about how much of a surcharge would be funding bottlenecks versus projects, sidewalk projects in East Portland. We heard from some legislators. So I think there's interest in further discussion about the distribution of the funds themselves and what kinds of things folks are talking about. And there is some discussion about how to create the process for that dialogue, and we'll certainly come back to you and make recommendations about how to pursue that. That would be a longer-term discussion, though, than just getting through this session and acting. So I think that there are jurisdictions with a wide range across the spectrum about governance. Some would like a new kind of thing that somehow they... I think what people forget is if we get into a fight about who's on this new committee, then we're probably all done trying to create the surcharge for this session. So I think that the biggest thing is to hold ourselves together on the structure we have. If people want to come and change the structure of JPAC, they can propose that. It takes the two-thirds members of JPAC and the Metro Council to approve a bylaw change, a structural change, which is a conversation folks could have in the future. But trying to carve out a new decision-making process in April to get out with a bill in June. It's just not going to happen. It will show the legislature we're not together, and they shouldn't trust us to hear it. As compared to what they've heard so far, which is that we are together. We have a robust governance process. We programmed millions and millions of dollars, built all kinds of projects, built light rail lines, developed regional transportation plans that are envied other places. I don't think we want to stick with that positive.
It's a good one.
Yeah.
Amen.
All I have.
Go ahead.
That's all I have.
Other stuff? That's all you got? Well, that's because they killed most of the bills.
Yeah.
And you did that when I wasn't here?
The land use bill that being submitted by Senator Mons Anderson, that's still a law.
Mons Anderson's bill did not pass.
About the
bill,
ADUs.
ADUs in rural residential.
It's dead?
Correct. Must have sure at the last minute change. There is another bill that is really about historic ADUs on historic properties with historic households in rural residential. That one got amended with a number of amendments that we suggested. We didn't support the bill, but we were neutral with the amendments that were made. Primarily, no ADU development in urban reserves, but we don't want rural level density built. I believe that bill was moved over to rules and without recommendations that are called. So it's still got a ways to go.
That's what
for the discussion. Yeah. That was kept alive.
She still has some life. Okay, other questions for Andy? Thank you, Andy.
You bet.
Council communication. Keep in mind that we have an executive session, so expedition would be.
Carl, I had one. I'll just tell you what it was. I wanted you all to know that the Army Corps will be opening a comment period on the final disposition study for the land of law on May 15th.
Okay.
So you probably want to send a letter, and we'll circulate a draft letter as soon as.
Okay.
Somebody else is doing this.
Other folk have anything? We're going to adjourn to an executive session. We have two things to do. We are going to do under ORS 1.